On behalf of the Federalist Society, I'm Carmine Icarino, an officer with the Central Kentucky Chapter, and I welcome you all to the first conversation in what will be a six-part series of conversations with Kentucky's Sixth Circuit judges. Over the months to come, we hope to hear from each of the Sixth Circuit judges with Kentucky roots and connections. And in addition to today's event, we've already scheduled the next part in this series, which is a conversation with Judge John Bush, also of the Sixth Circuit, and that will occur on June 25th. So please mark your calendars and keep an eye out for the registration email for that in-person event. It will be an in-person event that we'll be holding in Lexington. But for today's discussion, we are very pleased to welcome Judge Danny Boggs of the Sixth Circuit. And leading the discussion with Judge Boggs is his former law clerk, known to many of you, I'm sure, Josh Blackman. Josh Blackman is a nationally recognized scholar on constitutional law in the United States Supreme Court. Josh's work was quoted during two impeachment trials. He's testified before Congress and advises federal and state lawmakers. He regularly appears on NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, and the BBC. Josh is also a frequent guest on NPR and other syndicated radio programs. He's published commentaries in such leading national publications as the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. Since 2012, Josh has served as a professor at the South Texas College of Law, Houston. He's also an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. He's authored three books. His latest, An Introduction to Constitutional Law, was a top five bestseller on Amazon. Josh is the president of the Harlan Institute and founded Fantasy SCOTUS, the internet's premier Supreme Court fantasy league. He's also a regular blogger at the Vala Conspiracy, where I'm sure many of you have probably seen his setup from which he is currently live broadcasting with us. And he tweets regularly at Josh M. Blackman. I will turn this over to Josh so that he may introduce Judge Boggs and kick off this conversation. But before that, I do that, I'd just like to remind our attendees to use the dialogue box at the bottom of the screen to pose any questions. And at the end of the discussion between Judge Boggs and Josh, we'll pose those questions. And again, on behalf of the Federalist Society's Central Kentucky Chapter, thank you to Josh and to Judge Boggs for appearing today. And with that, I will turn it over to Josh.
Thank you so much. This is an honor. You mentioned that I am the president of the Harlan Institute. And of course, John Marshall Harlan was a Kentuckian. And I think I'm sitting with one of the greatest jurists from Kentucky since Harlan. So it's an honor to be here. I clerked for Judge Boggs in 2011 to 2012. Against better judgment, he hired me. And now he's sort of stuck with me and I get to ask questions. Rather than giving an introduction, I want this conversation to introduce Judge Boggs to all of you. And I want to do this autobiographical. So the first question is both about Judge and also about the Constitution. So Judge Boggs, first question, are you a natural born citizen?
I think so. It's interesting because I was born in Havana, Cuba, and in my hometown, and you'd think that the average person doesn't know much about the Constitution, but in Bowling Green, Kentucky, and many other places, people immediately said, oh, you can't be president. And I said, well, I always understood, and I know it's controversial, that a natural-born citizen was one who did not need to be naturalized. And because my father was a citizen at the time, although my mother was not, my father was in the armed forces, I have always believed I was a natural-born citizen, although I've never had to put it to the test.
That's excellent. So how did your father come to be stationed in Cuba?
Well, he was not stationed in Cuba. That's the first error. The story, very briefly, is my father was a young man in Bowling Green, Kentucky. That itself was strange because he was born in the Panama Canal Zone while his father was a conductor on the railroads building the Panama Canal. And they were from Texas, and long story. My mother grew up in Cuba, upper middle class family. Her father was an accountant. And for some strange reasons, there was a small business college in Bowling Green, Kentucky, founded privately by people out of New Orleans who had some links in the Caribbean. So there were always some number of people, Hispanics from the Caribbean, and some primordial Cuban had come up there. My mother was younger. I think her older brother had gone. And so she came up there and met my father, and nature took its course, as they say. And then my father went into the service, and nature having taken its course, he was basically an orphan. They thought it was better that she go back to Cuba to have me. So that's the story of how I was born in Cuba.
How much time did you spend there?
Oh, I think, 6 or 8 months. I was born in late 44. So by the end of 45, my father was out of the service and we were back in Bowling Green by certainly early 46. I mean, I have no memory of that period. We visited my relatives there many times, but that was all the time that I spent there.
What were some of your interests as a kid? Because you're such a wide range of interests now, but what's some things that interest you when you were growing up in Bowling Green?
Well, I was, interested in politics from a fairly early age. I read science fiction and boys, as it were, books. When I see how people are into Harry Potter, when I first saw it, I said, "This Harry Potter is just a Dink Stover goes to Hogwarts." There were boys' books, Dink Stover goes to Yale, and, the Lawrenceville stories about prep schools, none of which were immediately relevant to me, but were something I liked. I read a lot of science fiction, a lot of history. Played baseball and tennis and different things. Was moderately athletic, but not a whiz.
In high school, you became involved in debate. That's my next question. How did you get involved in debate?
Well, our school had a debate program. We had an English teacher who was a coach of it. And so, there was a program starting in seventh grade. And by ninth grade, I was on the varsity. We won the regional. And as a sophomore, we won state. So I was very involved in that. And every once in a while, I say, I know about that because I debated the British system of education. In 1959, we talked about testing. So, affirmative action and testing today has many of the same issues that we debated 60 years ago.
How did you go from Bowling Green to Harvard? What was that process like for you?
By the time I was getting up into high school, it was obviously, I had a great deal of academic talent, let's say. And my father, who had not, graduated from college, but was a smart man, and he was a postal supervisor, and so he sent off for college catalogs from 50 different colleges, and we'd read some of the catalogs. And after my junior year in high school, if you hear honking, it's people exercising their First Amendment rights to support marijuana legalization outside our chambers here. We've tried to suppress it, but tell me if it gets too bad. At any rate, especially there was a National Science Foundation had a program, to catch up with the Russians in Sputnik, and they had a math institute based on your scores if you took a national math exam. And I did and got into that program with 30 kids from all over. And, I realized I could compete with these. And so I figured I wanted to go to the best place I could get into. And that was Harvard at that time. Applied to a few other places, but I did get in. And that's how I got there.
And over the years, you've mentioned various famous people you come into contact with at Harvard. I know you had classmates and roommates. Maybe just give a few of the sort of the luminaries you ran into in your formative years.
I see. Well, not sure how luminescent all of them were, but if you're a math geek, one of my roommates was the top five in the country in the Putnam competition, which is like the Olympics of math. A couple of senators and governors, and some of them got indicted, some of them didn't. some of the great professors. I sponsored Zbigniew Brzezinski speaking at Harvard when I was head of the International Relations Council. That's one of the aspects about you know, to be blunt, Harvard or an Ivy education is who the other people there are. I mean, you certainly learn from your professors, but you learn from your classmates in ways that, you know, to me is a great part of that. Not that you can't do well at other places, but just to be brutal about it, more of your classmates on average are going to be interesting people who go interesting places. But on average, that's why every lecture I give about anything having to do with education, testing, etc., I always want to say, on average, every word that I say should be prefaced with on average, not absolute. But I guess I just missed Ted Kaczynski. He was in my same dorm, but the year before, Larry Tribe was one of the people who was in the same dorm with Kaczynski.
Wasn't Barney Frank one of your roommate or debate partner?
Frank was several years ahead of me, and we were antagonistic on most things, though not all things. Barney Frank was the same class with Tribe and a number of other folks that I knew. I mean, I had dealings with Frank.
Well, after college, how did you decide to go into law school, in Chicago in particular?
Well, I had assumed I was going to go to law school from certainly toward the end of high school. In fact, that math institute, in addition to teaching us math, they turned the psychiatrists and psychologists loose on us. And there are articles about that group of people. And one of them says, well, there were 30 people and 28 of them want to go into math and physics. One wants to teach romance languages and one wants to be a lawyer. And I became a lawyer, and the guy taught romance languages, and most of the others did go into math and physics, though one is a movie producer. So I was going to go to law school, and I had done pretty well in college on grades and extremely well on the LSAT, so I figured I could get in most any place. So I applied to Yale just to prove I could do it, because that was supposed to be the hardest. I applied to Harvard because that's really where I wanted to go. I was there already. And I applied to Chicago and Duke and Virginia. And my father, again, had looked at all these and pointed out that Chicago, as opposed to almost any other law school, had 10 full ride scholarships, 100% room, board, tuition, stipend, etc. And he thought it might be a good idea to apply for it. And I did, and I got it. Sort of went back to Harvard, and they said, well, we'll give you half and loan you half. And I had a younger brother coming up, so we decided I'd go to Chicago, which turned out to be a fine thing. I met my wife there, great education, fantastic group of professors, I thought, at the time and thereafter. But again, if you're an economist, the cost benefit, I guess the other thing was that these scholarships were chosen by a committee that was headed by Justice Clark of the Supreme Court, the head of the ABA, the head of the American Political Science Association. So that was kind of a plus, you might say. And when I got the prize, I got a letter from the justice saying, well, come down and see me if you're in Washington. So probably much to his chagrin, I did. I got about an hour of his lunchtime to talk about Baker versus Carr and other interesting decisions of the day. So it all worked out very well.
We'll get to Judge Judy Boggs in a minute, your lovely wife. You were at Chicago in the 60s during a very big period of turmoil. Maybe discuss some of the crazier things that went on, you know, on campus, and also maybe discussion of free speech, which was a very important principle, I think, that was developed during that time.
Well, it was developed much earlier. It was probably sustained more by Chicago, although at that time, no matter how bad you might say things got, there was never breaking up other people's meetings, which Josh has had some experience with. So the big thing was as a result, not really directly of Vietnam, but of some on-campus fusses about tenure. 300 people occupied the administration building. Ed Levy, who later became Attorney General, was president of the university, had been the dean of the law school. And basically he waited them out. And when they finally got tired, they expelled 50 people, probably suspended a couple of hundred. So there was real punishment meted out by a due process disciplinary committee that met in the law school, largely headed by law professors. If you know anything about Chicago, it's an all glass building, looks like an egg crate. And at one point, the radicals came over to try to break up the disciplinary committee and were pounding on this all glass building. And my wife remembers this very well. So there were all these law students inside the glass walls defending the law school. So I guess you could consider that something of a craziness. But that was the major thing that went on mostly the year after I graduated. I taught at the law school for a year. And in fact, the student government had me chair meetings of 1,000 people who were not necessarily anti the radicals, but at least were not in the administration building occupying it. So that's the things that I remember about that. I mean, the moot court competition, which I did win, was held the day after King was killed. So you could see smoke coming up from downtown Chicago while I was preparing for the moot court finals. But as I say, it was not interpersonal at the level. I mean, Bernadine Dorn, the famous radical, was in my tax class. She generally did not come, and the tax professor called on lots of people, and whenever he called on her and she wasn't there, he would say, "Well, out helping the poor again, I suppose, Ms. Dorn." That was Wally Blum, as a famous tax professor.
After you graduated, why did you decide to spend a year as a Bigelow Fellow?
My wife was the year behind me in law school. Yeah. And so that was the best way we figured to stay together there. We had just been married. My third year, her second year. I had done 2 summers at Cravath in New York. And I say, just to show you how, as they say, there is an inside track. I told them I wasn't going to come. I had an offer because of this. And they said, "Oh, well, just bring her. We'll get her into Columbia for her third year. Just no problem." So, but we were already well settled.
How did you and Judy meet?
She was a year behind me. She was a first year, and I was, as she says, I was taking law review subscriptions in a table in the law school. I saw her and decided to see how things would go, and they ended up going well for 53 years now.
And Judy is an administrative law judge at the Department of Labor, and she's also is the head of the AB admin law section. So she's
The chair of the benefits review board, so she's above the administrative law.
I mea culpa. Yeah.
No, because she has been the head of, quote, the administrative law judiciary of the ABA, and then chair of the ad law section. But basically, she's an appellate judge, the 5-person board that hears appeals from the ALJs.
My apologies, but I think very highly of her. I was very fortunate when I was in Kentucky to spend time with both Judge and Judy, and they're just such gracious people. Let's keep moving forward. So you graduate law school, you spend a year as a Bigelow Fellow, then Judy graduated. What was your next move?
Well, I was supposed to go to Cravath and be a Wall Street lawyer, and I had been involved in Kentucky politics in a mild way. I took 3 weeks off in the middle of second year and went down to Kentucky and worked on the governor's campaign, Louis Nunn, and he won. And so, like Michael Corleone, people drew me in and said, "Well, you know, you can come down here at 24 and be a deputy head of an agency, and decided I liked Kentucky. I was a Kentuckian. It's a good administration. And so things went very well. I did that. I became legal counsel to the governor. Judy became general counsel of the state mental health department. And so politics worked and then didn't work. Some people won, some people didn't. So after a while, I ran out of things in the government in Kentucky, but I got the opportunity to be in the Solicitor General's office in Washington. So that was how we left Kentucky. But I was in Frankfort. I was just talking to Carmine. I was in Frankfort from June of 69 to June of 73 in the state government right there in Frankfort.
How did you get hired by SG Robert Bork? How'd that come about?
Say going back to politics, Louis Nunn was supposed to be elected to the Senate in 72 when Nixon was elected, but that didn't happen. So I was somewhat at loose ends, and I saw that I did not know Bork, but I'd heard of him, and he was from Chicago and from the law and economics side of things. And I had, you know, done appellate arguments and so forth. And so I talked to some of the Chicago law people, and I talked to Milton Friedman, who had been one of his sort of mentors, and they all put in good words for me. And I went and interviewed, and that's how I got the job.
At the time, Bork had assembled a pretty all-star cast of young attorneys. Who were some of the other deputy SGs in your office at the time?
Well, the hierarchy actually was there's the SG, then there's three or four deputies, and then there were at the time about 10 assistants to the SG, which was the lowest level. So Frank Easterbrook was one. Danny Friedman was the first deputy. He went on the federal circuit. Paul Friedman, who's in the D.C. district. Ray Randolph, who's on the D.C. circuit. I know I'm leaving out one or two. I have a picture from that office, and there were about seven who became federal judges. Robert Reich was one. He did not become a federal judge, but he became a cabinet official. He had been a Rhodes Scholar with Bill Clinton, which helped.
How many cases did you get to argue for the Supreme Court, and which one was your favorite?
Well, I argued three, and they were, interesting. It's interesting. My brag was always that during the 2 years I was there, no private attorney argued more cases than I had. That would certainly not be true today for a person in the SG's office, but I argued one on the constitutionality of the gun control, the 1969 gun control law. I argued one on illegitimacy for Social Security benefits, which we lost. And I argued one on who owns the Great Salt Lake. So if you're interested in the geology of the Great Salt Lake, I'm your man.
A great case. What was the most memorable question you got from a justice during the arguments?
I really don't remember. I mean, I remember the generality of it, but it's interesting because it's on OES now. I actually haven't gone back and listened to myself. When I was preparing, if you wanted past arguments, you had to go over to the archives, and they had the cassette tapes of past arguments. Now, of course, it's all online, and apparently I think some of my clerks have said they have listened to it.
But I listened to your Salt Lake arguments. Good.
Okay.
It was fun.
Yeah, I was going to say, if it wasn't a question, I did. The whole issue, this is really arcane, was what are the waters, the rising and falling, slow and imperceptible. And
accretion and revulsion.
Right. I had briefed that the lake moved more slowly than the hour hand on the clock in the back of the Supreme Court. And I would try to convince them that it was imperceptible.
That's great. What was your next move after the SG's office?
Let's see. Well, I came back home to Bowling Green and ran for the state legislature and did well, but didn't win. And so then I came back to Washington with the Federal Power Commission, started my career in energy.
And when the Reagan administration came to town in the 80s, what were your, how did you get involved in that, in that movement?
Well, I mean, I had, you know, always been, you might say, on the conservative side of things, had been involved in intellectual organizations, and of course had been involved in these campaigns. So I was known to some group of people, and I was chosen to be on the staff of the Republican Platform Committee for Energy, for the Energy Subcommittee, and was on some advisory committees. So I was known to a fair number of people, and I had been the assistant to the chairman of the Federal Power Commission, and then I had been on the Senate Energy Committee. So, you know, given all of that, I was a plausible person in the energy area, and I was picked to be on the transition team for the Energy Department.
And then once you were there, you actually worked in the White House for a couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, basically, again, the story is I, you might say, frankly, thought I would be a candidate for chairman of the Federal then Energy Regulatory Commission. And about day three of the administration, I called some of my contacts, Martin Anderson, who was the chief policy advisor, and his folks. And I said, well, how am I doing for that? And they said, well, it's going to take time, but would you like to come over tomorrow morning and be the policy person for energy? And I said, well, that sounded like a good deal. So that was how that happened. The domestic policy staff, you had five people who were each in charge of an area, energy and resources, economics, legal. And so I was the person for energy and resources.
Eventually you were appointed as a deputy secretary of energy. How did that appointment come around?
Well, I mean, I had, as the policy person in the White House, I was really the policy point for the, especially the Energy Department, the Interior Department, and EPA and that sort of thing. And so I had worked with all of those people, and Don Hodel, who was somebody that I knew from that, was the Deputy Secretary of Interior and was being appointed as the Secretary of Energy. And he wanted a good person as the deputy. And so that was, you know, basically he picked me, ran through the White House and Senate confirmation. And that's how I got that.
All right. So let's fast forward to 1986. Someone wanted you on the Sixth Circuit, and there wasn't a seat to fill. How did your vacancy and seat come about?
Well, I'm not sure that that's accurate. At least you may know more than I. A bill had been passed in 82 or 83, creating four new seats on the Sixth Circuit. It had had 11. It had gone from 5 to 9 to 11. And so four new seats were created in Reagan's first term. And the deal was that Reagan would appoint two of them and leave two of them for the next election, which of course turned out to also be Reagan. And so there are four states in the Sixth Circuit. And the idea was that each state would get one. And so the Kentucky seat was still on the table at that time. And so that was how I got, that's how the vacancy came about. So it wasn't that, as far as I know, I was you know, happily doing energy, though I'd obviously done appellate law. And idea of getting this seat was broached to me by Senator McConnell. And it seemed like a good idea after I thought about it some. Because the side of appellate law, you know, had been where I was, where I thought my talents were. I don't think I would have been nearly as good as a district judge, and probably almost certainly would not have have given up the executive branch for a district judgeship. But appellate seemed to be right up my alley.
So you were appointed in 86, so you were about 42 at the time. Were you the youngest judge in the court at that time?
Yeah, I mean, it was 41 because I was actually, they sent me up in 85 and the didn't get accomplished and had to resend it up in early 86. So yes, at that time I was the youngest on the Sixth Circuit and the fifth youngest in the country, out of 170 or so.
How did you go about
it? By the time I left, I was about the 10th most senior. By the time I took senior, I was about the 10th most senior. So you sort of have a passageway there.
I have a spreadsheet for that. By the way, everyone listening, see, he still corrects me every 5 seconds. I feel like I'm still in this chamber. Nothing has changed. It's actually delightful. How did you go about setting up your chambers? I mean, deciding secretary, staffing, clerks. What was your thought process of how to set up your operation?
Well, I really, you know, in one sense, didn't know. I'd never been a judge. I had not clerked. The concept of, I have said that in the Solicitor General's office, we would read opinions and write briefs. And as a judge, you read briefs and write opinions. So the skill set is, I said, the difference is, as an advocate, you have to answer the question. As a judge, you don't have to ask questions. You can sit back. But the skill set is the same. The main problem was I was in Washington. They didn't have an office for me in Louisville. And it was sort of in the middle of the clerk year, which wasn't as formal as it is now. So I scrounged around and got some people who were in government whose agencies would let them go for a few months. And I scrounged some space in the DC circuit and just went to work. In fact, I was supposed to have a sitting, 3 or 4 months out. And I went down and did a swearing in Cincinnati that was scheduled the first couple of weeks of my legality. And then they said, oh my gosh, one of the judges who's supposed to sit has just gotten sick. Would you sit in and take this docket 2 days from now?
Oh, wow.
So I did, and that was kind of a crash course, but it worked out all right.
How did you go about with your clerkship hiring process? I know you're famous for the quiz. I'll just give the background. For those who don't know, Judge Boggs uses a knowledge quiz. Don't dare call it trivia. It's hardly trivial, but it's a quiz on a range of topics: art, science, history, math, music, everything. And he sends around these quizzes and he gives them to prospective clerks, and it's part of the process of hiring. How did you come up with the idea of the quiz in the first place?
Well, the first couple of years, because it's the process is a year or 2 years out, I really didn't get, I got good people, but I did not get a lot of applicants. But after going through a couple of years, because I didn't use feeder judges or feeder schools, I really looked at every application and I said, well, what do I really know about these people? There's not a whole lot really in applications. It's kind of sterile, frankly. You can get some ideas. And I saw a quiz kind of like that, who was the best friend of Patroclus and what's the capital of Zimbabwe and, name a poem by Browning. And I thought it just sounded interesting. So I said, I'll give it a try. And I came up with a bunch of questions. And for me, it worked wonderfully. You got to see, were people well-read? You got to see, were they interesting or quirky? And for interviewing, it turned out to be great because, you want to know about what they think about law, but it was good for thinking about other things. And as I got more and more and more applications, once I got really rolling, I'd get 100 to 300 applications a year. It also gave you a way of of communicating with, rather than just picking 8 or 10 that looked the best out of this huge pile, you could send the quiz to 40 or 50 who seemed pretty good. And then that gave you another data point to think about who you wanted to interview. And so, you know, it's wholly instrumental. It came about by chance, but it's worked very well for me, you know, even turns up people like Blackman.
Yeah, against judges' better judgment, perhaps. How do you come up with the questions? I mean, you're I'm going to boast, but you're a polymath. You know a wide range of things on many topics. How do you pick and choose the things that you want to quiz about?
Well, it's you know, I just sit down and write out things and then sift them. And of course, old clerks say, "Hey, this would be a kind of interesting question." And sometimes I take them, sometimes I don't. But you know, the idea is really, number one, do people know something about something? The questions are hard enough, but they're not absolutely abstruse, most of them. The way I put it is, if you know anything much about English history, you ought to know about Charles I and Charles II. You know, I don't want to ask you who's the 17th Earl of Arundel, but if you, you know, ask, you know, who's the second vice president of the U.S.? Well, if you know something about early, you know, Jefferson and Adams and Washington, you know, you ought to be able to figure that out. Or questions, do you know some math? What's a Fibonacci number? You know, you don't have to prove that you can, prove Fermat's last theorem. But if you know what a Fibonacci number is, you know something about math. So it's that kind of question.
You started giving this quiz before the age of Google, and now we have Google, where, you know, information can be found in a, you know, Siri, you know, who is the capital, whatever, right? Have you ever found kids or students who have cheated that you caught cheating on that made the interview realize that they Googled and they cheated on their quiz?
Well, people ask that, but if people answer everything, you're pretty sure they would have cheated. If they cheat on one question, what difference does it make? I guess two or three times I've had, you know, things that didn't add up, like, name a poem by the Browning is your favorite poet, but you didn't answer the question about name a poem by Browning. But almost never. I say, fairly recently, I had a guy who really did seem to know virtually everything. And then I interviewed him, and, you know, he had been in one of these honors, great books kind of college programs. And, you know, if you interview them when they can't look at Google and you ask them similar kinds of questions, what's the line? It ain't bragging if you can do it. So, yeah, I've never really had much problem. Plus, you know, you'd figure that most people who want to be clerks at this level are sufficiently egotistical that they want to show how much they could do. That's never really been a worry for me.
Wonderful. You've been on the Sixth Circuit now for more than 3 decades. What's been the biggest change in the court from the 80s, the 90s, to the aughts, to the teens?
I don't know. In reality, I haven't noticed that where I say that there's something radically different. We do less oral arguments and more cases on briefs, but there's still quite a lot of oral arguments. The types of cases ebb and flow with what's going on in the world. I came on, we just had the savings and loan crisis. So we had lots of things about the Federal Savings and Loan Commission. I haven't had one in years. We got a lot of immigration cases when Gonzalez, as Attorney General, tried to flush out a backlog, and all of a sudden we got all those appeals. We used to do more Social Security. That law has kind of settled down. So that the type of cases, there's some degree of ebb and flow. you know, as the sentencing guidelines, Supreme Court changes it, immigration law has changed, but in some mega way, I really haven't seen that much of a difference. You know, you get the cases, you decide the cases. Some of them are easy. Some of them are controversial.
How has it been since you've taken senior status? And now you can sort of spread your oats and go to different courts across the country.
Yeah. Well, that's been you're able to sit with other circuits even as an active judge, but it's much less common. I did sit with the Ninth back in the 90s a couple of times and sat on the DC Circuit once for a day just because I was in town and the judges knew I was when somebody fell out. But I've sat quite a lot with the Ninth and the 11th, and that has been interesting. You get to sit with other people, different kinds of cases there. It's been enjoyable, frankly, going to, you know, Miami and Pasadena in the winter and so on. And the Sixth Circuit, of course, is full, have all of our active judges, and we have a lot of seniors, so we're not our case, you know, our turnover is doing fine. You will get an oral argument in quite short order, which didn't used to be the case 10 years ago. So I've enjoyed that, and I've gotten to sit, and you get to be on some interesting cases, you know, different cases. I was on one of the church COVID cases at the Ninth Circuit here just quite recently, and
you got it right. Oops, sorry. maybe that's just true. One last question.
Yeah.
What's next for you? You know, I mean, in other words, I mean, you're senior status, you're still keeping a full caseload. What are some of the big things you're thinking about and things that you want to maybe do in the future? At the local time.
I don't know. Right now, just keeping on, I can see how I can cut back some, and of course that's a sort of decision you have to make in terms of your hiring your staff depends on how many cases you have. And I always tell myself I would like to do writing, but I always like doing my cases. So right now, for certainly the next 2, 3, 4 years, I see doing the same thing. I would hope some of our other judges have been going strong into their 80s and 90s. I don't know whether I will, but so far, as they say in Kentucky, God willing and the creek don't rise, I probably will.
Good. I think we're going to leave it there. This was delightful. If you have questions, you can raise your hand and put them in the chat, and I'm happy to relay them to Judge Boggs. We have one question in the queue. Would you share your quiz? If you want to email it to me later, I'll be happy to post on the Vol of Conspiracy if you're so willing. That was a question we got.
Okay, probably not the current one, but I could do
last year.
I could do last year's, because I haven't actually, you know, the whole question of how the clerkship process changes is an interesting one. I'll probably not be doing this year's until closer to, well, it is getting to be close to June. I guess it just reminded me I've got to start worrying about next year's clerk process. But I certainly can send Josh last couple of years. And there's several. There's a number of older ones that are on the web in various ways. I said that's another difference, is it used to be that it, you know, I would mail it out, people would mail it back, and it would circulate in sort of samizdat, that people would copy it and pass it around. And now people tend to post it pretty quickly. There's articles that were done by New Yorker and ABC News that have sort of canonical versions from a few years ago. But I'll send you last year's and you can pass it on. Great.
Well, please, if you have any questions, you're welcome to chat or comment. Please go ahead.
I might ask one question of you, Josh. Maybe ask the interviewer here. Judge Boggs and you were both talking about the quirky questions. I wonder if you recall, what's the quirkiest question you recall from your quiz, Josh?
Oh, there was one. I think it was, if the moon was made of cheese, how much would it weigh? Is that something, Judge, something like that?
Yeah. I think what's the,
the volume. Tide, how much water was displaced?
And if cheese could float, that is, because you don't want people to figure out how much cheese weighs. But if you say, if you know that cheese floats, then you know it's got to have a specific gravity less than water. You should be able to get that. My favorite was always, because I said, nobody has ever gotten all three parts, which is identify Bucephalus, Belisarius, and Bocephus. And for those who don't know, Belisarius was the great general of the Byzantine Empire. He saved Justinian's empire in 500 or 600. Bucephalus was Alexander the Great's horse. It means ox-headed, cephalus for head. And so these classics guys, they're hot to go on this. And then Bocephus is Hank Williams Jr. If you see his album, is my name is Bocephus. And so the people who know Bocephus don't usually know Belisarius and vice versa.
Carmine, as you can see, he's well-rounded. I mean, that's the
I try to make them attackable from different bases. Like, one of them is, well, who died first, Hitler or Stalin? Well, you should know something about the Second World War. And I forget, I had another one. And the third part is, who died first, James VI of Scotland or James I of England, of Great Britain? And the answer is they're the same person.
And I'll tell you, one year we were at
the English history, then the act of union is an important thing.
Yeah. When we were in Cincinnati for sitting once, some of the other clerks wanted to challenge us to trivia bowl. We're like, no. we were like, no, that's okay. You guys go play yourselves. we didn't want to, anyway. We have a question. Philip asks, do you anticipate more oral arguments now that the COVID restrictions are lessening, in person or on Zoom?
Well, the court in June, we're going to have our first in-person arguments. For this time, counsel were told they could come or not. We're running about a little under 50% of counsel, but almost all the judges are coming, three or four are remote. But the amount of arguments that we chose to have was about the same. The way we've organized it, and other judges could go into this in greater length, but the panel gets a chunk of cases and then decides which ones to argue. And frankly, some judges will pick more and some will pick less. I think there is some tendency to hopefully have more oral arguments out of the major docket, but that's really up to the court collectively and then to the judges on the individual panels. We still have probably more oral arguments proportionally than most circuits, but not as many as we used to. We used to run about 220 oral arguments per judge a year, and now it's probably more like 120. Still a lot more than the Supreme Court.
All right. Anyone questions from new people? Haven't asked a question yet. I'll make sure you give everyone a chance to ask questions. Let me ask a related question, Judge. A couple of your clerks have gone on to TV game shows, and we have Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. What was it like being on the receiving end of the Regis Philbin phone call?
Well, it was, organized, and you sort of had to be on call because you didn't know if your guy was even going to get into the chair. And so it was kind of, you just blocked out a piece of time. One time it was in chambers, one time it was over at a friend's house where we were had planned to have supper. And of course, you're a little nervous because you might embarrass yourself. I guess the two times, one of them, I gave him the answer, and that was nice. And the other one, was the $500,000 question on how many people played the roles of the Three Stooges. And I told him to take the money and go home, and he did. So in a sense, that was right. Although just to show that knowledge isn't everything, was I came to the courthouse the day after I had given Brian Colt the right answer for Captain Aubrey, and he then failed on the next up the line was where did Oprah have her first job? And I came into the courthouse, and one of the staff ladies said, "Well, you gave him your question, but I could have told him that other question."
That's so funny.
So he got 32,000. The other guy took it was $250,000. It was the $500,000 question. So maybe he should have flipped the coin on it, but he took the $250,000.
Let me ask you another kind of a fun question. You've done a lot of sort of fun travels around the world. What's been your favorite place to visit?
Oh, I don't know, as a place to visit. Went to New Zealand recently. That was nice. I led three American delegations to Moscow, teaching Soviet and then post-Soviet judges in 1991 and 1993, and sort of for, you know, interest and excitement being abroad. That probably would be top of the, you know, it certainly wasn't luxurious. The communists decreed that winter ended on May 1, so they cut off all the hot water while we were at the academy, the Soviet academy. But it was truly interesting and exciting to be there during that period, because was there while Gorbachev was still in. We're there right after the coup failed and the statues and barricades were still toppled in the streets. And then I was on the Soviet equivalent of the McLaughlin Group, or the Russian equivalent, at the television station that was later attacked during one of the uprisings between Yeltsin and the parliament. So I got some genuine excitement from that. We spent some time in Italy. Northern Italy was beautiful. We rented a Palladian villa built by Palladio for all of my friends and relatives. That was quite nice.
All right. Seeing there are no more questions, Judge, anything else you'd like to add or to on your mind?
No. Hope people have enjoyed it. I've enjoyed it. I've always want my. I think the Central Kentucky or Lexington chapter. I spoke when they were formed 25 years ago or so. I'm not sure exactly when, and I think things have gotten a little more sophisticated. I remember I was introduced by saying, "Well, we're the Federalists. We're against judicial activism. Tell us why we're in favor of judicial restraint." And I said, "Well, it's a little more complicated than that." I'm sure on the intellectual side, we will have discussions of activism, restraint, and engagement, as the term now is. But that didn't seem to be the topic here today. But I always enjoy my presentations with the Federalists.
Wonderful. That's all I got. Carmine, thank you so much. Judge Boggs, thank you. And to everyone, hope you enjoyed this. You learned a bit about this great Kentucky jurist. And I'm hopefully to be with you in person at some point in the future.
We would really enjoy that. Thank you to Josh for hosting and leading off with questions. Thank you, Judge Boggs, for your participation. This was a very interesting conversation. Glad that this was the first in a 6-part series to come. I'll take this opportunity just to plug the event I mentioned at the top of the hour, which is our next in this series. Our next event is with Judge Bush, June 25th. Keep an eye out for the email with registration details. It will be in person in Lexington. Thank you again, Judge Boggs and Josh. And thank you to all of our attendees.